Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a thing that is nothing at all, and yet everything at once. My name is Teague Christie, and I'm talking via the fabulous web technology Skype to my friend Abby Phelps.
Hey there.
From the forum, and we were talking on the forum yesterday about movie posters and being idiots about it, and then it started getting interesting, and then we both had to go back to work, so we decided to reconnoiter and discuss the topic at length in the form of an audio thing that y'all can ignore. Welcome to it. Abby, it's nice to talk to you for the first time. Hi.
Yeah, you too. As 8 years ago, Jesus, it's been that long. If I had been told I would eventually be doing an audio thing with a Down in Front cast member, I probably, my head would have exploded. So I'm happy to be here.
So, I mean, we were talking yesterday specifically about what are the net effects of Hollywood new thought as relates to like the market and all the incentives that they're working with these days, as opposed to previous generations. What is new and how is that affecting the way that posters come together and are used in the advertising for the movie? And then I imagine that this will basically broadly zoom out from that into a larger conversation about just what the new incentives are and how it's affecting movies generally and not just posters. Does that sound sort of like where you could go with this?
Yeah, definitely. I've been thinking about those things and depressing myself at length for like 5 years now. So,
right. Good. Me too. This is perfect. This will be very, very disappointing. This will be depressing to everybody. So just to like start somewhere, when I was walking around last night, when I was considering this recording, and I was thinking, what is the most like umbrella way of categorizing what is going on possible? And when I tried to find it, I ended up zooming up farther from posters and then farther from the like industry at large, and basically zooming all the way out to the application of labor to the effect of having a desired like artistic outcome. And I realized that basically what seems to be driving everything is best expressed by the three-word phrase, difficulty begets preparation. With everything getting easier in all ways, the need to prepare has either been like obviated or circumvented or just left aside. And that is what's driving basically everything else in terms of quality, where if it's hard to make anything, like to make any movie at all is incredibly difficult at basically every time in history prior to 2000. And we can fuzz when it started getting easier, but prior to 2000, it's definitely hard the whole time. Like, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is like the first DI movie that matters. And it's not, it's around 2000, 2001, maybe. I don't remember when exactly it was.
I think 2000.
2000, cool. Then prior to that, we're just doing like color timing and planning and lighting. That's all we're doing here. And we're not scanning the plates into a computer to edit them. We're doing this on a flatbed. Like, the whole thing was hard at every stage. And the very nature of it being difficult led to more preparation simply being logistically required. Just to walk in the door, you need to know what the script is going to be before you can start making the like special effects for it or the music for it. Like, you have to do it in a much more like procedural manner that doesn't all happen at once without preparation, but is like set up as this like snowball with a kernel of an idea for a movie and a script and a project and a team. And then one by one, they all start doing their things, and one stage affects the next and affects the next. And at some point you have to figure out when it's going to come out, but that isn't decided like about in advance or anything like that until like the 80s. I think Ghostbusters was one of the first movies that called their release date in advance of production, but that was because Ghostbusters wouldn't have gotten made but for that timeline. So it wasn't even a big deal until like 10 years later. For a long time, movies were just, I have an idea for a story we need to tell. I would like to tell it as well as possible for multiple reasons, but not least of which is every single person working on it is going to be working on it hard for a very fucking long time. And we also are limited by the way that we can get the word out because of the same exact like timeline. It's not easy to get the word out to everyone. It's not even easy to communicate an image to the mass market very easily. So we really have to figure out how to tell the story with our poster. And we really have to figure out how to encapsulate the vibe with our poster and all that. Because for a long time, the poster was the only like film forward aspect of that project. And in terms of like the ethos and what the vibe was gonna be, it was the only way of describing to the most amount of people what it was going to be, and you weren't going to have many options for doing that. It wasn't like there was an infinite number of teaser trailers or a big ad campaign with a bunch of one sheets. It was like, here is the poster of the thing or whatever. This is going to be a movie that feels like that. Isn't it weird? I have no idea what to expect from this, but it's going to be like that. They're making the whole like communication of what the movie is going to be on the single image that they were able to like cobble together that explains it. And that seems to be like the driving metaphor for what posters were. While the designs and all the history is evolving and the different tropes and the formulas come and go, the thing that's happening until fairly recently, consistently, is that the poster is essentially giving you all the information you need about the movie, assuming you're not going to get another chance to do that. And recently, it seems like posters have taken on a meta-contextual aspect where they assume that you're going to see other parts of this ad campaign elsewhere. So they're not trying to rely on, like, for instance, preparation to communicate an idea very, very specifically and clearly. It's more like, you know, we're going to take 45 shots at explaining this movie to you. And we might even try a different ad campaign if the first one doesn't work. Like, we got all kinds of options here. We're not, you know, we're no longer preparing the entire idea for the movie in a bolus that will be represented in a some sort of a visual metaphor that'll be pretty. It's like we got, first of all, we got all kinds of ways to describe the movie to you once it's out there. But secondarily, but relatedly, we didn't even really prepare this movie that much anyway. So it may or may not be something that we can ourselves describe that clearly at the beginning when we need to make a poster. So like all of these like very various aspects of difficulty, from the difficulty of getting it out into the world in the first place, because there's just not an infinite number of ways of getting an image in front of people. It's basically bus stops and like the sides of movie theaters. And then eventually the movie itself, it's just like posters. And if you're at the theater, a trailer, but that's it. There's only one way to do it, which is difficult. And also all of the aspects that made filmmaking difficult prior to like 2000, all of these things in combination lead me to suspect that basically the problem is things got too easy and difficulty beget preparation. Ease doesn't preclude preparation. It's just, why would you prepare if you can basically just fluke your way through it? And I think that's ultimately what's driving everything else. What are your thoughts?
So really it goes back to the whole Jurassic Park analogy from years and years ago, where it's like, you know, where you said, you know, back then they spent so much time investing in the 99% of the CG that the last 1%, it was like, well, fuck it, we might as well just do that because we've come so far. Whereas now it's like, well, we can just get the 99% done within, you know, weeks. So why should we go to the effort of putting in the 1% that's going to kill us? I do think it's interesting that it's sort of two sides of the coin, where on the one hand, you know, you're right, the preparation is getting less and less and they're just relying on the names of IPs to sell things without actually having a coherent vision. But at the same time, preparation is also, in other senses, what sells the movie more and more, and that, you know, they've been preparing with Marvel specifically. They prepare the slate of movies like years and years in advance. We knew that Avengers 3 and 4 were coming out like 5 years ago, something like that, because they already had worked out what three movies they were doing per year. So even though they aren't necessarily preparing the films themselves, they can rely on preparation to sell them, in that people have been aware of Avengers, you know, Infinity War happening years before it's actually announced, just because they put out the release slate. So they already have built-in, quote, marketing right there, and that they can just rely on, well, okay, we know we have the title there, and we know people know that we've signed RDJ to come back and all this sort of thing. So it's, they can have this really kind of slapdash form of preparation, which is basically just an extended press release over the course of 5 years without actually having any coherent vision of, okay, but what's the story going to look like?
Right. And what is the story going to look like seems like a very particularly good way of expressing what the job of the poster at least used to be, is to describe the story in a different format so that it can be communicated to people who can then make a decision about whether or not, like, it's ultimately, posters are advertising for what? Like in the old days, I would say, and by the way, I'm now winging it, but my understanding would be that in the old days, the poster is advertising the story, like the content of going to the theater and watching the movie. It's not necessarily an advertisement for the movie, subtle distinction. It's an advertisement for the experience of going to see this movie. It's telling you, do you think you're going to like it or not based on this visualization of a metaphor that describes to you what you're going to be seeing. And it's not like they were always brilliant images. I mean, you go back and look at a lot of them and they're not actually particularly specific about the movie. Like one of the most famous posters of all time, and it's not like top three, but it's like top 50, would be like Anatomy of a Murder. And that is a really, really distinctive poster, and it's got that Saul Bass vibe that we love, but it doesn't actually tell you much particularly about the movie, whereas...
Well, and that's like the extreme of that is like, you know, the Polish posters, where it's like the guy was like high on LSD, and like, I'm just going to make the coolest visual possible, and I haven't seen the movie because I'm in Poland, so fuck it.
It's like a cheap like grocery store sci-fi novel cover. And a different one, like to contrast against Anatomy of a Murder from around that same time, might be, this will probably be a poster you haven't seen, so you should Google it, but the poster for Love in the Afternoon is really interesting, because, and I'll describe it if you're not looking. The poster is essentially a white field that you assume would have a window in it that you're looking through, and you're seeing Gary Cooper and Audrey Hepburn making out. But over the entire window is a sheet, like a window blind that's been pulled down by a cartoon hand, and it looks like the hand might be about to just let go, and you're going to see the thing go up to the top, and you're suddenly going to like reveal Gary Cooper and Audrey Hepburn making out or something. Like the idea,
yeah, that's fantastic.
The idea here is come and see this movie if you want to see what's going on behind this window with Gary Cooper and Audrey Hepburn. That doesn't tell you anything about the story, but it does sell you the experience of going to see it. Do you want to see what's behind the window? And then the two names are supposed to carry it. That's simple, but there's a lot being communicated by that about the experience particularly, whereas a lot of the stuff more recently, it hasn't been like the movie lowercase m experience being advertised to you. It seems like it's been the movie universe being advertised to you. Like, especially and particularly in the MCU, but I mean generally, an awful lot of it is aesthetic and setting and art tone, but not story tone particularly. And I wonder how much of that has to do with just the like the normal simple influence of just we're lazy and let's Photoshop the two leads or whatever. Like we're going to do something pretty basic and ultimately DVD cover-ish, regardless of what the movie is. So it doesn't like it could just be that we're just lazy and that's the look now and no one's thinking about it. And they just choose not to. It also could be a deeper problem where we're really not in a position anymore to express a uniform idea of what a movie is supposed to be in advance. For the same reason, it's not wise to do what Babe Ruth did and point at where you think the baseball is going to land and say, this is what we're aiming for. Pop it. And it goes and you see if it's going to hit it or not. It might be a little bit too like boxing themselves in to announce the movie in the way that the old like posters would have done. By the time you're making a poster in the old days, it has been decided what the movie is going to be and how it will be sold because there's not much selling to do and what it is has been clear since Jump. Both of those things aren't true anymore. They want to just keep focus testing it until you own it and keep trying to repackage it. And in that way, it's like, why would you pick a single iconic image? We don't know what's going to sell yet about this story. You know, we're not going to really pick the theme of the ad campaign until we've at least seen the fucking trailer.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like with the whole we don't want to pick the iconic image, we don't know what's going to happen yet. I feel like lending credence to that is stuff like less with Marvel and actually with Star Wars. So like the Star Wars saga installments for Disney Star Wars 7 and 8, those were actually Abrams and Johnson got a pretty high degree of artistic freedom. But with the spinoffs like Rogue One and Solo, like it was, you know, huge in the news when both of them were undergoing extensive reshoots, because basically with Solo especially, the entire movie ended up being redone with like months to go until it was supposed to come out, because they were like, this is going to test badly with the focus groups. What are we going to do? So like if they're willing to reshoot an entire movie because they want to make sure that it hits the best mass audience possible, then yeah, I would absolutely believe that they're like, well, we can't exactly make this poster distinctive because that could turn people off, or we don't know if this is going to make it into the movie. So on and so forth.
I mean, the way that manifests itself across the field, the whole industry, is just wanting to make decisions as late as possible. And obviously that makes sense. The incentives of the studio would be, I would like to have as much freedom to make it as many executive decisions about the shape this thing takes until the last possible minute. And to give you two examples of what other stuff that is driving, one would be the previous way that TV screens used to have stuff on them in movies was someone's job would be to prepare whatever the content would be on those screens and then do a cool like sync up with the 24 camera so that the screen in the set would be synced up with the film and you'd be shooting it on set. And that has been entirely replaced, 99% replaced by every single TV screen on a set is green or whatever, but we know in advance that it's going to be replaced in post explicitly because we don't yet know what's going to need to be on those TVs. What if it needs to be something kind of backgroundy, expositiony, et cetera, et cetera. We need to be able to tweak what's there for the sake of the edit until the last possible minute. So let's just assume in advance that there's not going to be a choice made there. And it's basically absolving the need to make choices early so that we can make them later and just rejiggering the incentives of everyone so that can happen. Another example would be John Williams for Star Wars 7 was asked not to score the film, but to write suites that could be located against themes when needed, but don't actually like rest up against the edit in any meaningful way. I mean, you listen to the 20-minute Jurassic Park coming to the island cue. Journey to the Island, it's like it's sculpted to fit the movie and the edits and all those things. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can even go back to Pirates of the Caribbean in 2003 and watch that first sword fight between Jack and Will Turner, and the hits are timed to like the spotting of the track very specifically. It's written to the edit. That doesn't happen anymore. And when it gets to John Williams, who, if there is a single god of movie music, even John Williams is being asked, yo, we are still going to be editing this movie until about December 0th. So can you just give us Ray's theme as a suite, like an overture, and we will like kind of fade it up music editor style when we need it, rather than scoring the movie, because we don't know how the edit's going to keep changing. And it's not possible for someone to write a score to an edit that hasn't been locked several months in advance. So the best you can do is write music that's sort of in the vibe. But this would be the same thing as like not making a decision about the poster until we know what it's going to be. They're basically trying to figure out at the latest possible minute in every possible way how maximally they can sell it regardless of what it tried to be in the first place.
Yeah, well, and the same philosophy applies to just how the movies are shot in general, too. Like one of the things that's really nice about The Last Jedi, actually, is going back to your John Williams thing. Williams was actually able to score that picture because they got it in the can soon enough. And part of the reason of that is that Rian Johnson actually chose to frame shots a certain way. Whereas, like, if you go to, like, the Russo brothers for the MCU movies, they are deliberately shot with as little framing in mind as possible. They are shot to maximize coverage so that they have every conceivable angle of a shot in case they need to put it in an edit in a different scene or a different tempo or whatever. So if they were to, you know, specifically frame shots, it would be, well, no, you can't do that, because then if we have to reshoot the sequence, we're fucked. We have to go over and shoot the whole thing. Whereas as it is now, it's just like, well, we have it covered with like seven different cameras and most of it is CG anyway. So we'll be able to fix, you know, change this entirely if need be. So like there's no like specific, like, you know,
choices. There's no preparation, my friend.
Yeah. Like if you go back, like even as recently, like if you go back and watch The Dark Knight, it's, you know, The Dark Knight is held up by internet dude bros as this, you know, holy grail of movie making, which it isn't, but it's really goddamn refreshing to watch a movie and go, Christopher Nolan chose to shoot this from one angle with a single camera for a reason, and it looks nice, and it makes sense in the context of the scene. Whereas you can go to basically any Marvel movie and go, this looks like it was shot for a TV show because they needed maximum coverage, so it's lit so everyone's face is in the frame, and yeah, it's just mush.
You're right, that is a really good third example. And the last Marvel, the last time I watched a Marvel movie and thought this scene was directed by somebody was the opening scene of Guardians 2, where it's this one, you're watching Groot dance and everything happens in the background of that scene. That was a director's idea. It was from like soup to nuts, specifically a vision that you had to want to make like that the whole time for it to have happened. That feels like a choice being made. It's that kind of shit I'm talking about. Anyway, so I think we've found the sort of soft spot in the middle of this conversation where everything is going to basically end up sliding into. What were your thoughts about posters in the last like day as you've been thinking about this? And, you know, to be redundant if necessary, but whatever. What kind of stuff has been on your mind poster specific?
Well, it's posters, but also marketing in general, because I've also been thinking about trailers in regards to the posters. So after we had our initial conversation, I was thinking more and more about like that sort of marketing in general. And thinking about what we were saying here, let me just pull up the page where you're talking about it. But yeah, the way that I phrase it and that you then distilled down my statement was, we're now having marketing that shows nothing for movies that tell nothing.
I love
it. You know, it's, you know, we simultaneously have this culture that's spoiler phobic, but also spoilers don't actually matter.
Yes, and I love it. I love it, yeah, so much.
Well, and I feel like probably the pinnacle of that as relates to movies, and I got to pick on the MCU again because, God, they just make it so easy, is the Avengers Infinity War trailer that hit. There's a bunch of shots in that that don't make it into the movie, not because they were cut, but because they were wholly fabricated for the trailer. They never existed in the film.
Oh,
man.
They were
made just for the trailer. And that's
that is fucking cheating.
No, yeah, it is solely designed to, A, have an iconic image that doesn't exist in the film because they're like, well, fuck, we need all the Avengers charging across the battlefield, and it isn't in the movie, doesn't maybe have that much to do thematically with the movie, but the fans will go nuts, so we have to use it. But also it's because people are so obsessed with spoilers in this day and age and like that dissecting that sort of thing that they're like, we have to throw out fake plot bones for them just so that A, they can have this thing to chew on for the next 6 months and they won't actually spoil anything. And B, so that the ones who are worried about getting spoiled won't have anything to worry about. And it's just, it's just this perfectly frustrating thing of the marketing experience has basically become this vessel to dump theme in regardless of whether or not the theme applies to the movie, because the movies are themselves such empty vessels.
Yes, exactly. Another thing that just occurred to me as you were talking is a very significant change here that isn't covered by the original premise, the just things getting easier, like difficulty begets preparation, is that what used to be a one-way track of information from studio to audience is now quite a bit more like an everlasting focus group. That's a very specific difference. It's the constant feedback from the audience thing in advance of the movie coming out. That seems like it's probably not great for the trends we're talking about.
Yeah, no, especially because with something like the MCU where it's serial storytelling, you're always going to be in that feedback loop and it'll never end because you're always going to have them complaining about something in between movies. Like, I remember the Russos, when Captain America Civil War came out, they said in an interview they went into the movie with the goal to make it CinemaSins proof.
Ha!
Like, that was their biggest concern because douchebags like CinemaSins are always complaining about movies. It's a constant cycle where the fan base will always be finding new things to feed on and the studio is going to be constantly adjusting. So like you can probably watch over the course of, you know, 10 movies in real time, Marvel reacting to what fans like and what they don't like. And it's just this insidious Ouroboros.
Right. And the fans they're reacting to are the ones that get the most audience themselves for their critiques. And the ones that get the largest audience for their critiques, the ones with the critiques that are the most superficial and hilarious and understandable. And I get it, regardless of if they are legitimate fucking CinemaSins. And also, all of the deeper stuff, all the people, like all the reactions that they should be attuned to are not being observed by the most popular of the shit-ass film critics. And so they don't get observed by the process of improvement. It's this like perfect superficiality river rock making machine. It'll just round everything down into this completely unassailably superficially charming thing that doesn't make the mistake of getting boring by like having meaning or whatever, like by having diversions away from that vibe, even for like a scene or two. It's a very specific constant temperature. And this is where MCU comes back into it again, but it also applies to everything else. And it's definitely not just MCU because every other fucking movie is a sequel.
No, yeah, it's like actually probably the better analogy for this whole line of thought is actually the DC universe. Cause like I am not someone who defends Batman versus Superman at all, but the one thing about Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman, where it was Zack Snyder at the helm, it's like you could definitely see that even no matter how bizarre and stupid it was, there was definitely a one man's vision thing going on. It just happened to be a vision of LSD and fascism, but still, it was.
We call that Zack Snyder.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, but there was some thematic coherence there.
Have you met Sucker Punch?
Yeah. Oh God. But after Batman and Superman came out and Warner Brothers panicked, it's just been this slide. So like, I think it's really noticeable because like in the fucking Aquaman trailer, which also just, oh my God, we as a culture just spent $200 million to make a fucking Aquaman movie, kill me. But also like you watch that and it's basically, you couldn't distinguish that from a Marvel trailer if you didn't know that it was DC. Like they've gone so far in the opposite direction of we have to be quippy and light now because that's what the audiences want.
Right.
The more like depressing and just awful example is with Suicide Squad. When the first trailer to that movie hit, it was incredibly well received by the internet because they were all like, oh, yay, pop songs and villains. We like this. But at the same time, it was a mess behind the scenes. And, like David Ayer and the studio were battling over the cut. And the studio goes, OK, they really liked the trailer. What do we do with that?
That's what happened to Surrogates.
Yeah. And the studio head's answer was, we're having some trouble with the edit here. David did a cut and we don't really like it, but our cut kind of sucks. Oh, we have the trailer house that cut the trailer edit the movie. And that's what happened.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
The trailer house did the third edit of the movie.
Okay.
It's like you couldn't pick a more literalized example of just reacting in real time and going, that 2 minute clip the audience liked. Do that.
This is, I mean, honestly, can I give everyone a big old note here? Make a trailer, then write a script. If we're going to invert this shit, Let's do it right. Have people make you trailers. Have someone write a script to expand on the trailer. I have handed you this possible, this like DVD full of different trailers. Which one would you like me to write based on this?
And at least then they're going from an idea. Like, you know, when the Age of Ultron trailer years ago ended with like Captain America's broken shield, it's like, that's an interesting image. Someone should make a movie about that.
But that's a really interesting way of looking at it. What they are doing is basically becoming insecure about the risk because they do not know how to replicate success unless it's in the rubric of what's already succeeded, because the art is dead. Within the paradigm, we're not talking about all movies. We're talking about blockbusters, ultimately. We're talking about the movies that are trying to get a worldwide impression on everybody, basically at the same time, or within a couple months of each other, just to recoup their expenses. We made Pacific Rim so it would sell everywhere, sort of thing. We are getting very good at churning out predictable results, and that is the heuristic we are chasing, rather than anything else. Literally every other heuristic is thrown aside. We are getting very good at predicting the results of what we make, and we have realized that that is the least risky way to move forward. But that predictability is the ability to right the ship until the very second it makes it to port. And none of those heuristics lead toward a ship that has like the ability to displace water and stay upright. It's just, can we get it into port without all of our money exploding?
Yeah, well, the longer the ship sails, the more and more money is weighing it down. Like, we've gotten to a point where, you know, even like, you know, maybe 8 years ago, it was unusual to have a movie with a budget above $200 million. Now that's every single franchise movie in like less than a decade later. Like, we got to the point where Solo, the spin-off movie, because they shot it twice, had a budget of $300 million. That is, like, even just brushing aside the moral implications of we could have fed X many people and instead we made a shitty Star Wars movie. Yeah, it's not going to get better. It's only going to get higher. And it blows my mind that, you know, 5 years from now, the bubble hasn't burst. We could be having $400 million movies as a semi-regular thing.
Yeah, I mean, y'all know my position on this one. I think it's going down at some point. I think it's going to pop because it's not fucking sustainable. But to whatever extent, and let's try to drag it back to posters, I guess. But to whatever extent, the downfall of specificity, the late stage flexibility, when it comes to posters, the manifestations of this are things like a campaign full of one sheets. Like, I can't tell you how many times, but it is more than three or four. I have been driving through LA, because when you live in LA, there are movie posters for everything everywhere all the time. When you're driving around like bus stops and stuff, it used to be that you would be seeing like Mark Zuckerberg's face. You don't get to 500 million friends without making a few enemies, that kind of shit in those bus stop ads. I can't tell you how many times lately it's been pick a primary color. That's the background. Invent some crazy DreamWorks character who is, yes, doing a DreamWorks face, or a Pixar character who is, yes, doing a DreamWorks face. And it's some, like, it'll say, like, whoever is playing that character at the top, and oftentimes it will be something like Kesha, or like a mononym that grandparents are not going to know what they're looking at when they see it.
Yeah.
I've seen Dwayne Johnson described not as The Rock, but as Rock. So it'll be a character with no meaning to you, a title of a movie that has no meaning to you, and then the actor at the top has no meaning to you. And this is one in a campaign for a movie that you cannot describe as you are staring at the poster. It's like, Rock is acorn in fart. And it's just this like decontextualized thing, which clearly they think is doing something worth paying for. I cannot put my finger on what that would be, because the obvious answer, since Star Wars has been selling toys, but I put it to you that there are not toys being sold. This cannot just be about toys. It has to be about, like, the contracts. It's got to be like, I will get a special one sheet is in everyone's contract now, or something like that, because nothing else explains it that well. People do not care about the movie because, like, all of the posters you're putting out in the world, you're just diminishing how many you put out into the world for your movie if more and more and more of them are not about the movie but are about characters within it. Yeah. You're blurring the announcement of the movie happening at all.
Yeah, I feel like even more than contracts, it's just they have to keep this constant state of buzz going where they feel like they failed. Like, you know, if you go to the movie subreddit, which is a horrible place, and you never should. Like, I use it for news, but then I always get sucked into viewing the discussion posts and I feel like I have cancer afterward.
Sure.
But But if you look at those things, it's like every single time there's a new production still from Infinity War of this character in the background, and it'll have like, you know, 10,000 upvotes because everyone is like, new content. Yes, I like the thing. And so if you want to keep that cycle going, it has to end up being a thing where you're like, okay, three trailers aren't enough anymore. These people are just so obsessed with finding new Marvel content. I guess we have 20 posters, including for this character who's in it for 2 minutes, because it's still going to get a ton of engagement and going to drive people to talk about the movie more, which is more word of mouth for us.
Right. Word of mouth, I would say, has generally, I mean, word of mouth is the wrong term. I mean, word of media, but,
yeah.
word of Twittering, and I mean that with a lowercase t, but the word of like the internet Twittering has become what posters were, and what used to be the, this is our one image, we're relying on this one image, has basically become an infinite number of ways to make an infinite number of impressions for who, like it's targeted like everything else is. You know, it's targeted like Russia targets voters. It's not ubiquitous. It is atomized. So everyone's getting a slightly different version of the fucking ad campaign. That's interesting. I mean, I suppose it might maximize certain aspects of what they're going for, specifically and perhaps like most of all, just how frequently someone clicks something related to your movie. Like if you can like release one of those one sheet posters every day for a week today, like Rihanna is tweeting about the fact that her poster came out today. And then tomorrow it'll be Chris Pratt. Like that kind of thing is generating more impressions than you would have otherwise had in everyone's little individual walled garden of audiences. Basically, they're trying to conglomerate to all the audiences they can. That's what it is. They're advertising to existing audiences in a way they didn't before. They're advertising to specific sections, not sections of the market, sections of the demographic of the movie. That's what it is. They figured out how to break a movie down into the best messaging, best with whatever amount of quotes you want to put around it, for this. Like it's not even the messaging for the movie. It's literally the messaging for the ad campaign for the movie.
Yeah, it's like, well, we got to get the Tumblr teen girl demographic, and they love Bucky. So here's a poster of Bucky, and then you know if we do Chris Pratt, that'll loop in some Parks and Rec fans, and then RDJ is for the teen douchebags, and it's just, yeah, you're right.
And then I mean, you get to the point where they're asking themselves the question. How can we make the most money pursuant to being predictable about it? If you do what Pixar did and spend a decade and a half doing nothing but perfect fucking movies, people will come and watch a Pixar movie for the next 30 years because of the association of, I trust Pixar. But if you can't like work hard enough to prepare a film that will like lead to a pattern of trust developing, the next best thing for making as much money as possible, if you can't just make a good movie reliably, is just to like turn the volume on the ad campaign up as much as possible.
Yeah, well, especially because like, you know, making a good movie is really hard. And Pixar had the quote, you know, we think good art is good commerce, but they're kind of fucking wrong. Like,
you're right.
If you look at Pixar's grosses, you know, all their initial, you know, the wave, like however many films was it, the first 10 films, they did well at the box office, but they didn't start getting $1 billion grosses until they started doing the Toy Story 3s and the Cars 2s and the Incredibles 2s. And that sort of thing. Like, it's just as much as we would like to use good art as good commerce as a, like, you know, defense against neoliberalism encroaching in on art, it's not true. They can make way more money doing it the way that they're doing it.
I mean, I agree with your premise. The other way of looking at it might be that it just takes that long to build up the brand.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
But I think that's actually a really interesting yardstick to use. Is what would theoretically explain Pixar's box office trend line. Let me pull that up. That's interesting. Well, this is not going to, I can't do this fast enough because my computer is set up wrong for this right now. But the first several movies are like 190 million, 160 million. Toy Story 2 is 245 million. Monsters is 255. So 339, like 191 through 339 is the first five movies. The last five movies, which would include The Good Dinosaur. So 123 is cheating. Let's do the first four and the last four. So as to get The Last Dinosaur out of the fucking list. The first four are like 191, 162, 245, 255. The last four are 486 for Dory, 209, 152, 608 for Incredibles. And yeah, I mean, as you look down this list, there it definitely goes back and forth, but the heavier numbers are at the end and the lighter numbers at the beginning. The first one they had that was 400 or up was Toy Story 3. Until Toy Story 3, the highest one they had was Nemo. So yeah. What is doing this? Like what it's partially just the market and inflation and all of that.
Yeah, I think the other thing you have to take into account is that, you know, most of the newer movies are sequels, and they have a whole audience that used to be kids and now they're adults and buy movie tickets.
Right.
Which is also why Disney is pouring so much cash into live action remakes that are, you know, artistically bankrupt. No one will talk about them 5 years from now, but boy, oh boy, do they make money.
All right. Now I got to get scatter chart. Thank you, Excel. So yeah, it's definitely an upward trend. It's like an upward trend at like 15 degrees. It's crazy. It's really significant. In any case, it doesn't feel like what Pixar is doing has changed since they decided that they were going to do sequels. Like, they're still doing generally really good movies. Like, Coco is great. Dory was fine. Incredibles 2 was good. I didn't see Cars 3. Monsters U was okay. Inside Out was good. I mean, Brave and Cars 2 were not well received.
Yeah.
But Toy Story 3 up, like, at least, like, the last 10 or 11 Pixar movies have done pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
The other aspect about this is like, as like Dorkman famously pointed out, Pixar movies are generally hard to pitch to people because the story is too dense to pithify. And I wonder if that plays into it. I wonder if one of the aspects that has made, oh, you know what? This connects. What if what it is because it's so difficult to sell a Pixar movie in advance of having seen it, it's more effective to make a trailer and a ad campaign for a Pixar movie that is a sequel because you don't have to sell it for people to want to see it.
Yep, that's it.
If the premises were always difficult to like codify and express via metaphor, the easiest way to sell them would be to have already sold them and just build up from there.
Yeah, I think you got it.
Interesting. Weird. Good, like, way to pull up Pixar, though. That was an instructive example.
Oh, thanks, But yeah, them and Disney both, because yeah, with the live action Disney remakes, it's the same thing where like you look at the grosses of the live action remakes compared to the original animated movies, and it's kind of just really depressing. Like,
yeah, it's huge. Like one of the highest grossing movies of all time is that Beauty and the Beast movie that just came out.
I want to tear my eyes out.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I mean, I already did like a 10,000 word rant on that or something when it came out, because it's genuinely my most hated movie of the decade, but it's just.
Oh, shit.
God. No, it's so terrible. It's so bad. Well, and now they're doing, this year, they're doing three of them.
Aladdin.
Dumbo is March. Aladdin is May. Lion King is July.
Holy crap. You're right. I have heard of all three of those, and I hadn't even put together that I had.
Neither had I until I saw the slate, and it's like, I was like, you gotta be fucking kidding, right? But nope, they're all within 2 months of each other. Which you would think, my one hope is, oh, please let this be the moment where they eat into their own profits too much and it collapses. That's my hope, but I'm not exactly counting on it either.
With the remakes of the Disney movies and with the sequels in Pixar, it just occurred to me a very obvious, very stupid, very, very dumb thing just occurred to me for the first time. It would be easy to say that these two things were correlated. I am now saying I think they're causal. I'm pretty sure sequels are a marketing decision. I'm pretty sure sequels make marketing more effective, and that's why they do them. Like, there's already the extant argument that sequels are easier to predict the audience for, which makes it less risky. But separately from that, like, I previously thought the horse pulling that cart was risk. It might also be the most effective way to advertise something is for everyone to already know what it is.
Well, and that's also probably why, you know, if it's not a sequel, it's chances are it's an adaptation of a book or a public domain thing. Like, you know, the new Robin Hood movie that's, you know, it didn't work out for them. It's tanking, but people are like, who asked for a new Robin Hood movie? It's like, no one asked for a new Robin Hood movie, but just by virtue of using the name Robin Hood, we have a guaranteed recognition by all these people who wouldn't care about a steampunk medieval fantasy thing.
I wonder what the role, like in the context of this conversation, I wonder what role the franchise of Spider-Man plays in terms of like softening the ground for, you know what we're going to do every 2 years for the next 10 years is a different fucking Spider-Man franchise that begins with a fucking origin story. We have reintroduced Spider-Man like 4 times in the last decade.
Yeah, we're coming up on number 5, I think, with the Into the Spider-Verse animated one.
It's news to me, but I buy it. And I wonder if that wore us out. Like, we did. I thought Batman was happening too fast. Like, it was like, we just did a Batman and we're doing another Batman. But that followed from having done 2 Spider-Mans and already done a third, and then a fourth one was coming out at that time. Maybe, like, I wonder if Spider-Man, which initially was, I thought they were, like, floundering. And it's funny now to remember that Spider-Man the Musical also floundered. Maybe Spider-Man is just fucking cursed. But for whatever reason, I always thought Spider-Man was just floundering. I thought it was a bad look for the franchise that Spider-Man was floundering and they keep trying it over and over again. But I wonder if what I was perceiving as a bad look was secretly, like, they were discovering that they don't get punished for making bad franchise versions. So why don't we just keep trying that until we get one that lands? That's weird. I hadn't thought of that before, but maybe they're like, we realize we don't get punished for doing these, so let's nail it and we'll eventually get there. It's like we have an infinite number of pilots for a movie franchise.
And that's exactly how it worked out with Venom. The whole reason that Venom is in Spider-Man 3 is because Avi Arad, the producer, is fucking obsessed with the character for some reason, and he keeps shoehorning him into different Spider-Man things, knowing that eventually it'll work. And it just did, because the Venom movie is going to cross $900 billion at the box office pretty soon here.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
No. God, no.
I have no idea what to expect from that shit.
The only superhero movies that I have seen in the last 3 years have been Black Panther, Logan, and Wonder Woman in the theater. Those are the only ones I got into the theater to see.
I didn't see Black Panther or Logan. I've heard Logan was good, and everyone says Black Panther is good. I did see Wonder Woman, and that was like me and Chloe were with our dads on an island for a weekend, and it's like, what do you want to do? Let's go see a movie, sort of. All right, well, I guess we'll see this movie, but we wouldn't have seen it otherwise. But I think that was the last, like, I saw Deadpool 2, like, on a plane, but I think the last Marvel movie I saw was Wonder Woman, and then before that, it would have been Guardians 2, and then before that, I think it would have been Ultron. Like, mm-hmm. it's really dropped off.
Yeah, well, the last one I saw before those was Ant-Man, and the only reason I went to that was because I wanted to see the Star Wars trailer in front of it, which worked out for me. It was a great trailer, but honestly, this is a tangent, but with Logan, I would kind of encourage seeing it because it felt like such a breath of fresh air, because it's basically the antithesis of everything we've been talking about in terms of, like, franchise zombies. Like, the reason it works so well is that Jackman definitively said, this is my last movie, we're making it an ending, and so it could actually be about things and have stakes.
Yeah, which was, make it count.
Yeah. Well, and it also, because they knew it was going to be the last one and they knew what they wanted to do, it looks like a movie. Like, it looks like something was shot with intention and there's framing. So, like, it's not, you know, a masterpiece of a movie, but it was so goddamn refreshing walking out of the theater being like, I feel like I just had a complete viewing experience as a person.
What is this feeling? I feel like I went on a journey and I understood it the whole time and it had meaning and it changed me a little bit.
There was no post-credits scene where Patrick Stewart recruited this new person to play Wolverine now that Hugh Jackman was out. What's going on?
Can I just point out something that's like, this is super snarky and superficial and shitty of me, but I want to point out something about the modern trend of movie making that I speak to the entire movieverse right now, the blockbusterverse right now. You know that the premise of drama is changes, right?
Well, they know it just enough that they have to pay lip service to it and then just undo it before the next one. Like, Captain America Civil War is supposed to be this thing where it's like, you know, oh, we're breaking up the team and everything's going to be forever changed. And then at the end, it's like, Steve's like, no, Tony, if you ever needed me, I'll be there. We're still friends. Or with Thor Ragnarok, the whole point of Thor Ragnarok is that he learns that he doesn't need the hammer to be a god, and he has the power inside him and what, et cetera, whatever. Then in Infinity War, his whole quest is, I need to make this axe so I can kill Thanos. Like, they have to give you the illusion of change to make you feel as if you haven't wasted your time, but then immediately undo it at the beginning of the next movie because otherwise they don't have the franchise anymore. Like, actually, probably the best example is, you know, as far back as the first Avengers, where, you know, the end of Thor is all about he has to, you know, shatter the Rainbow Bridge so he can't go back to Earth ever again, and it's this whole sacrifice he has to make. And then in Avengers, oh, you're back. Father must have coughed up a lot of energy to get you here. Moving on.
Let's get real gross and mean and weird about what these movies mean for audiences. And, like, this will just be straight up navel gazing on both of our parts. But do you think we are being unnecessary assholes about this? And that this can be a fine and whatever healthy ever meant when it came to watching movies, healthy way of ingesting your media? Or do you think there is actually a legitimate change in the effect that movies will have as an institution on people who are used to this style rather than previous styles?
I'd say if these were a cult thing, we were being assholes. But the thing is, they've won. It's $2 billion a movie. Like, this is the culture now. So it's not like we're, you know, stepping on some nerd and taking his lunch money. It's like, they've become the people they sought to destroy. Like, that is what is driving culture now. So, like, I don't think that it's unnecessarily assholish of us to pick on the movies. I don't even think we need to, you know, to analyze, you know, whether it's gonna be a good or bad thing in the future. We can already say, like, blockbuster filmmaking is a wasteland. And, like, obviously, there's always gonna be the thing where it's kind of like Socrates complaining about, oh, these kids today, they have no respect for their elders, etc. And, like, everyone has been saying this. But you can look at, like, the 1980s and concretely say there was a fair percentage of original blockbusters every year that were good and had meaning and were made by filmmakers who had intention, and that's just gone out the window. If you think about the last original, like, original blockbuster not based on any franchise that had a meaningful impact on culture.
Gravity, maybe?
Even Gravity, it's not a thing where it's, like, become a cultural touchstone. I mean, I love Gravity, but I don't know a lot of my friends who do.
I was going to say honestly, Pirates. I got nothing. Big Pirates is obviously a franchise.
It's Inception.
Huh.
Inception was like 8 years ago.
You're right.
And, you know, probably over half a dozen things in that are just part of the culture now. You can just start riffing on them without context and people will get it. It's just sunk into us that much.
Right.
There's nothing since then at that level that isn't just cannibalized something from before.
Living totally within the point you just made, it is incumbent upon you to zoom all the way out and realize what you just fucking said. Of all the movies in every one of those years, none of them were both original and sticky.
And the only reason that Christopher Nolan could make Inception 8 years ago is because he just made two superhero movies. But eventually it's going to be a thing where we have this whole cultural wasteland where for however long this bubble is going to last, for that whole time, there's just no cultural touchstones that we can point to like 30 years down the road. Like we could with the 80s and say, you know, Indiana Jones was a thing that has since had impact on people's imaginations. Back to the Future was a thing, et cetera, et cetera. There's nothing like that that isn't based on pre-existing media anymore. So it's just this graveyard of IPs, basically.
I just pulled up the Box Office Mojo 27, the domestic here, but 2017 and 1987, just to get a 20-year spread on it, and or a 30-year spread on it, and 2017, so number one would be Last Jedi at 620. That's domestic.
Mm-hmm.
620, right? 1987, number one, Three Men and a Baby at 167. Wow. And then I'm going to go through just 1 through 10 on 2017, and you tell me if any of them is original. Last Jedi, Beauty and the Beast, Wonder Woman, Jumanji, Guardians 2, Spider-Man, It, Thor, Despicable Me 3, Justice League. I'm going to keep going until one's original. Logan, Fate of the Furious, Coco, 13.
Jesus.
In 1987, we got a sequel in number 3, which is Beverly Hills Cop 2. But other than that, we got Three Men and a Baby, Fatal Attraction, Beverly Hills Cop 2, Good Morning Vietnam, Moonstruck, Untouchable, Secret of My Success, Stakeout, Lethal Weapon 1, like Lethal Weapon non-numbered,
mm-hmm.
Witches of Eastwick, Dirty Dancing, Predator. Throw Mama from the Train. What's in there? So like,
and then Princess Bride is just like buried somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, Princess Bride has got to be on here somewhere.
It didn't do that well in theaters, so I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, Princess Bride is 41st. It made $30 million. 41 in 2017 was The Hitman's Bodyguard, and it made 2.5 times that much money. $75 million. I'll point out it was an original story, so hey.
Yeah.
Not bad. So what is the purpose of a movie poster in this economy? I mean, the answer that comes to mind first would just be it doesn't mean anything. It's one of several meme-based communication platforms communicating a very simplified version of an idea that we hope will spread enough. Like, it's just one part of many. Like, does the poster itself particularly have meaning anymore? Like, it's funny because yesterday we were talking about posters, what we do these, like the way that people see a movie, you go to Netflix and they have like 9 different covers for each. It's not just that they cycle them, but they show you a different one. Like you and I would get different posters for insert movie name here.
Well, going back to your meme thing and demographics, that's about depending on what you've been viewing, the algorithm changes the art.
Right. They are chasing us. They are not leading us. They are following us. It's a focus group. And since everyone has already demonstrated they are willing to keep showing up for it, it is more predictable, but it's not going to keep up with the price of inflation, I don't think, but that's a separate issue. Like, I mean, this is the thing I always get into trouble with, though. This is the trouble we got into with the fucking blockbuster bubble intermission. It's like, so it seems like any second now it's going to fucking stop. And it has seemed true this whole time. And it seems true more now than it did then.
Well, I think I think in your video essay thing, you were onto something, though, where you said they've managed to get the last gasp of optimizing the model, which is nostalgia. And eventually that's going to break just because they're going to run out of things to reboot.
After nostalgia comes the, like, let's make a TV show out of a movie, which is the MCU. And I don't think there's much after that. Like, once you've already played on the nostalgia and movies are no longer getting you enough money, even with the nostalgia shit, like the movie model that we've agreed upon for the last 100 years, we're going to, over the course of the last 10 years, move from a world where anything more than 3 movies in a series was frankly weird, unless you're James Bond, like Lethal Weapon and Die Hard. We make fun of those latter ones. And Jaws, we make fun of Jaws 5 because it sounds fucking awful. And it did the whole time. But then, like, the last 10 years, that part, that 100-year institution or whatever, not to say there hadn't been examples of larger franchises than that, but if in 2001 you had heard they were going to make an Indiana Jones 4, you would have been like, that is gross and tacky of them to do. And we no longer
and though it was so.
Clutch on to that instinct. We are losing it. It's going to be us and then no one else below us who has that feeling. But... and you don't have to, like, carry it like a torch or anything like that. But, you know, it's worth remembering, no one below us will have that association. And you just go one further to the overall problem of this movie isn't just one movie. It's an ongoing event that you see in movie after movie after movie. And also, it doesn't change. Like, it's like every single thing became James Bond or Doctor Who. Like, every single thing became this static, infinite trilogy. Like, everything I know about drama tells me this cannot continue to pay dividends. It must diminish. But I don't fucking know. I strongly think it won't, but I've been proven wrong for the last fucking 7 years, so who knows?
Well, it'll stop paying dividends on the movie screen eventually, but they're just going to pivot to television then, I think, is the next step. Like, I mean, now that Disney's opening their own streaming service and what have you.
But that's when the budgets will come down.
Yes.
Because right now, the only way to recoup your... like $200 million is to hope for $400 million, but you're not going to be able to get $400 million at the same rate anymore. It's honestly just a ratio thing. It's when the overall grosses relative to the overall budgets start getting a little bit closer together. That deceleration is the margin call happening. That is when the music has merely slowed and it's going to break. I would imagine, because at that point, what can you do to get $400 million? The best thing you can do is hope to not fuck up. You basically, once those margins get closer and closer together, guess what comes back? The need for it to be good. And that's too difficult and too risky. So at this point, I think everything just like drop. I agree with you that what's going to happen after this is stuff like Netflix. But that's where the budgets fall back down to like reality, because you don't expect to make $500 million from Daredevil on Netflix. You expect to make back what you put into it times 3. Because you made it fairly cheaply.
Well, that's already started to happen with horror, actually. Like
you're right. You're totally right. That's a great insight.
Yeah, and like that's because, you know, they're making the movies for $10 million each, and a lot of them are shitty, but there's also ones that are excellent, like Get Out, or are crowd pleasers, if not necessarily excellent, like the new Halloween or the new It or whatever.
Right.
And they're guaranteed several hundred million dollars off of that. Like it's like Blair Witch Project to a lesser degree, but it's the same principle where it's like, oh, you know, we spent the catering budget for Infinity War on Get Out, and it got Oscars, and it made $400 million, and now we have Jordan Peele as a name.
You're totally right. Good drama went to TV. Good horror went to Netflix. Good love stories do okay, but not very often anymore. Those have just become, I don't even know what they were. I don't even know where the fuck they went. What's left at the movie theater is visual effects. Like, that is it. That is the tail that's wagging the dog. That is the value. The horror stuff can't compete anymore because there's nothing about it that's like it cannot chase the $200 million monkey there. Nothing else can. The only thing that can is the comparatively rare spectacle stuff.
Yeah, well, and it's not. Yeah, well, then like that also extends kind of beyond visual effects. Like, I mean, Bohemian Rhapsody, which is a terrible movie, but that's a separate issue. That's almost at $600 million right now because that's its own kind of spectacle. And then, yeah. Of course, now it's going to be a thing where they're going to do, oh, well, we have to make 5 other musician biopics now because that's what sells. But even then, it's kind of visual effects based. Because like the whole selling point was the last 20 minutes of the movie or the Live Aid show, which we've recreated meticulously using visual effects. And isn't this amazing and great and huge?
Yeah.
And so maybe that's the next step, is you're going to start seeing visual effects applied to genres that really don't need them. And that's finally when it starts bursting, is when it hits that point.
Can I tell you what should happen? Here's what should happen.
Please.
Given the givens we have given, if the nature of this is to eventually isolate what will sell most, best, hardest, as essentially an artifact of value relative to what other people can produce, if we wanted to like invent an alternate steampunk future of how movies could go, which would operate within those rules, but not be fucking meaningless, movies shouldn't be comic book visual effects extravaganzas. They should be incredibly expensive event documentaries. They should, or Gravity. They should be like Gravity. When you realize that what movies are selling is novelty, the fact that what they are currently selling is total conformity suddenly becomes baffling.
Well, the novelty thing, I sort of feel like that's why, you know, Mission Impossible has only been doing better and better as it goes on, because like every single movie, it's like, Tom Cruise is an insane egomaniac and we're going to watch him almost kill himself a new way this time, and no one else would ever do that.
Right. But also, yes, I agree. Like, I see how that is the same thing. But also, that is also just watching like a new episode of Doctor Who. Let's see what he gets out like this, like how he gets out of this one this time. I wonder if it could be something closer to like, I suppose where I'm going with this is epics, but not epics in terms of swords and sandals, epics in terms of human experience. Like, this is a documentary we shot in space. This is a documentary from in a volcano. This is a documentary from the Mariana Trench, mixed in with high, high budget visual effects demonstrations of shit. Or look, we're not going to spend $200 million letting you watch Wonder Woman walk around for an awful lot of time. What if we just said none of that shit mattered anyway? We're going to spend $200 million recreating photoreal copies of old battles from history. Nothing has ever visualized Gettysburg for you, but you can see it now because we can, and why wouldn't we? And that's novel as shit. And suddenly it's like I can imagine whole worlds of really, really fascinating novel shit. Like not 10,000 BC or Apocalypto. I suppose that would be proof that my point is bad, but those weren't good.
Well, you also, I mean, to prove your point, I mean, what's the highest grossing movie of all time? What showed us something we could never have seen before?
Right.
Avatar.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, it's impact on the popular consciousness aside, it's still the fact that that made more money than any other movie has in history.
You are right.
Based solely on.
I'm sorry. That's exactly correct, though. Like, it could be. The joke has always been, hey, you know any Avatar fans? Of course you don't. Hold on a second. Let's zoom out from the joke we just made. We are saying that the most profitable movie of the modern era in the modern accounting has no fucking fans. No one came to see that for any reason, but it was going to be crazy. Mm-hmm. This would sell the point I'm making. They all went to see it like a goddamn traveling museum exhibit.
Well, we're gonna have to see how that continues with the four sequels that he's shooting now. Like how the marketing for those goes now that he's lost the ability to market it just solely based on this is gonna melt your face.
We need to wrap this up at some point, and this will be fun because I like going way out on a limb for the purposes of history. Would you like to place bets on how Avatars 2 through 9 are gonna go?
Sure.
I am pretty sure. Here's my reasoning. Because the thing that made Avatar was not. And by the way, what made Titanic Titanic, everybody? The thing that made Avatar was not the story. It was the, oh my God, this is going to be happening in a movie theater near me. And that is something I want to see. Like, that is something I want to see. A pronoun is what I want to see. Not the title of the film, just that. That was true for Avatar. That will not be true for 2 through 9. The last movie that was even remotely true for was fucking The Hobbit, yo, with HFR and 48. No one saw that shit. Like, I don't think that's going to work for Avatars 2 through 25 to the third power. I'll bet you it goes like this. In terms of overall profit, like the bar graph would be Avatar is 100 feet tall. And then it's going to be Avatar 2 is 61 feet tall. Avatar 3 is going to be 70 feet tall. Avatar 4 is going to be 70 feet tall. And then it's going to go down from there. I think it's going to be low, a little bit higher, same, and then lower from there.
Yeah, I would love to create some conflict for interest. But no, I agree with you. I think that, you know, Maybe the second one will get close to a billion, and maybe the next two will kind of equal that, but after that it's just going to be down the drain, unless Disney can like plug them into the marketing sphere somehow now that they have the Avatar world at Disney World, which that's something to consider, I suppose.
I wonder, let me end on Gravity, because I want to make sure that my theory is not totally stupid, but if indeed Gravity did well, which we're about to find out.
It was like 700 million, I think.
Yeah, worldwide. Not bad. All time worldwide. Well, 101st, so there's that.
$723,192,705.
Okay. So that's for a movie that has, like this is a really useful, this and Avatar would be very useful control variables. And Titanic would be an interesting comparator because Gravity and Avatar are both sold on the same premise, which is you ain't never seen shit like this before. And I'll point out, Gravity had like 1/4 the marketing that Avatar had. Mm-hmm. So like I'm sure if you were to look at the marketing budgets and then if you were to control Avatar's success to Gravity's marketing, I'll bet you Gravity does about as well or better. In both cases, it's an artifact of how well people have been told that it's going to blow their minds. But once they find out, they seem to go see it.
Yep. And they also both did very well foreign box office, too, which is, you know, important for longevity because that's where the trend is going. Like The Force Awakens did really well, but that was because it made $1 billion in America alone.
And to that point, and I'm glad you brought that up because I would have forgotten it, and it's a huge point. To that point, one of the reasons all movies have gotten kind of so simple lately is because you got to fucking redub it for 45 markets. And like the same story won't make sense in every single market. So you have to like make the movie. So one of the reasons like Titanic and Avatar and all those movies do well is because everyone can understand the story. But explicitly to the point of like an Avatar, Gravity, like a Gravatar kind of movie, which would be, no matter what language you speak, the story isn't even the goddamn point of it. If it is true in the United States that you ain't never seen this shit before, that is a global statement. When you advertise it, people believe you for now. They believe you and they will go fucking see it. Like, it seems like the alternate universe that we could be living in is one that's, it's, I'm not framing it. I wish I had landed on a better framing of it, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that doesn't sound realistic at all. So I'm bumming myself out mostly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the unfortunate thing about being a fan of movies in general, is it's just turned me into a cynical bastard before my time.
And the thing is, like, all the movies you want to talk about that you love, none of them have fucking heard of these movies.
No, like, yeah,
one hears about these movies that are good anymore.
Like, I still think about Phantom Thread, like, on a literally daily basis, almost a year after I saw it, and, like, the only people I know who saw it is because I dragged them to the theater and made them see it.
To your point, I didn't, but I don't go to the movies anymore. But to our point, I don't go to the movies anymore. So that had a cause. Who knows?
Yeah.
In any case, where does this... Let's leave this here, because I was going to stop on Gravity, but that kind of... I mean, I like that point, but now I'm just curious. What does this leave you thinking about longevity? Not for movies, but for you. Does this make you wonder about the horizon of that? Or do you think you're basically going to follow the love of storytelling into the corners where it finds itself burrowing, and that might just take you away from the movie theater eventually?
Oh, I mean, I'm always going to be following movies, I think, just because, you know, independent cinema is as good as it's always been. But in terms of blockbusters specifically, I've gone on record as saying that after Star Wars Episode 9, I'm going to take a vacation. And maybe it'll just turn into forever, I don't know. Because, like, you'll get the, you know, you'll always get the exceptions like Mad Max Fury Road or something of that nature. But for the most part, it's like in terms of franchise filmmaking, like the only reason I'm going to see the new Star Wars movies is because Star Wars is just such a huge part of my life. And I like Star Wars Episode 7 and 8. But even so, it's like after Episode 9, it's like there's nothing to tether me here anymore at that point. Yeah, in terms of blockbusters specifically, I don't see my longevity holding out much longer after Star Wars is finally over and done with.
Hmm.
Yourself? I mean, you already have ceased going to see movies very much.
I mean, yeah, I'm certainly tapped out on Star Wars. It is now, I can now say that it is formally no longer true that I have not seen a frame of Rogue One, because when Ryan heard that during the Phantom Menace commentary, I went to a party with Ryan and Mickey and Brandon and his girlfriend and me and Chloe last week, and Ryan and Mickey's baby Jace, who is awesome.
Hey.
He's a very cute little chill baby. And Ryan had brought, to my surprise, as a surprise, like a 10-minute supercut of just the space fight scenes from Rogue One. Like, you got to see this. Just, you got to see what we're doing with Star Destroyers now. So I watched that. And we were sure to get a reaction video because I was never going to see it again. But other than that, like, I haven't seen any Star Wars since Force Awakens, including trailers, including, like, stills and shit, with the exception of that 10-minute chunk of Rogue One. Oh, and he showed me CG Tarkin, but I was talking the whole time because I couldn't get over how dumb of an idea it was to include it. And no, CG Leia. In both cases, like, nope, last minute, pull it.
Those aged terribly less than a month after they were out. I don't even want to go back and look at them now, just because it's like there are PlayStation 4 characters for video games that look way, way better than that.
Yeah, the second Grand Moff Tarkin came on screen, I was like, clue.
Yeah, well, I'm like,
there was a bad Jeff Bridges CG face in Tron.
Yeah. Well, I like what a just a perfect visual encapsulation too of us literally reviving the corpses of old franchises. Like, God.
That's on point. Yeah, I'm out at this point. I very rarely see movies in the theater, and when I do, I like it's Pixar generally. I mean, now it makes me worried about Pixar, but I guess this is all just part of the same thing. These movies are no longer trying to be something that I am tuned to appreciate, and that might just be what happens when you age out of an evolving media.
Yeah. I feel like Toy Story 4 is going to be the Rubicon for that for Pixar, because like that's the one where the referendum is like, is there any artistic merit to this one whatsoever, or is it just
totally
you guys are falling victim?
Yeah, like, is it just me, or like, I'm assuming, is it true for you that since you first, like, day one, read Toy Story 4, you were like, no, guys.
No, yeah, it was like 4 years ago, I think, when they announced it, and I was just like, yeah. Oh, God. I probably wouldn't feel that way if they hadn't so clearly intended 3 to just be the end.
Right.
But because they did, it's like, how the hell are you going to justify this? From a story arc graph, if nothing else, how do you justify this? So, yeah, we'll see, I guess.
It bums me out. Because, like, you are right. There are, first of all, there are intermittently very good blockbuster movies, and Fury Road would be one of them. That's an incredibly constructed movie. But also, you're right that, like, a lot of good movies are still being made, and I do like watching those. It's just, boy, everything, even the things that aren't, everything seems so cartoony. And by cartoony, I don't even necessarily mean aesthetically. I mean in terms of stakes. I mean in terms of weight.
Yes, nothing matters and the characters equip algorithms. That's all it is.
Tell nothing ad campaigns for show nothing movies.
Well, and on that note.
Hooray! This was fun and exciting and optimistic.
Yay. I mean, yeah, it was fun, even though I kind of feel like crawling into a hole now. Like, well, I always do that sort of thing.
Well, this is why I ended up leaving movies, is because I can't not think about this shit. And like, when I think about the incentives driving macroeconomics in movies, I just zoom out to the macroeconomics of the world and why this is all happening. And it's like, oh, this all looks like fucking doom. It's just like, ah, it all looks like one big ongoing march of time that's related.
I guess maybe that's why I'm still can stay invested in movies to the degree that I am. It's like, well, the whole world is ending now anyway. It's not like I'm not going to be not depressed if I turn off the movie news. Like, oh, I'll go follow politics. That's sure to make me cheery.
Yeah. Escapism is a weird drug, especially when it's being sold to you in a targeted way by an AI for the products of a company that could not care less about the individuals that it's marketing to. It's weird. It's a weird time we live in. But, you know, at least the posters are terrible.
Yeah. Well, we can always look at some fan-made ones for free online.
They're so good. There's so many good ones.
There really are. Like, I've started just, like, printing them off and slotting them into my Blu-ray cases now, because it's like, it's just, why? Why would I look at the Photoshopped heads floating there when I could just have this?
It's like that. It's like the meme with Buzz Lightyear. Faces. Faces everywhere.
Faces everywhere.
Anyway, this has been a rambling conversation with my friend Abby.
Hey.
Yeah. And it's easier to do these things when there's a pat intro and outro to swing into.
You can always find more episodes on the forum. I'm trying to see if I can remember the old Down in Front monologue, and I know I have it in my head, but I can't actually say it.
This has been Down in Front. You can always find more episodes at downinfront.net. I got the whole thing still locked, man.
Subscribe to us on iTunes. Get a brand new episode every single week. Twitter.com/downinfrontshow. Facebook.com/downinfront. downinfrontshow@dlog.com. Matt Fata Beta is the show notes, chat breaks on iTunes. Holton Hill is on the website. I have been Abby Phelps.
And I have been T. Christie. That was so much fun. Thank you very much for listening. Good night. Ha ha! That was great. Well done.
Thank you.